Welcome to episode 110 of Primary Care Update. I'm Mark A. Bell, a family physician and professor at UGA and editor-in-chief of Essential Evidence Plus.
I'm Kate Rowland, family physician and associate professor at Rush University.
I'm Gary Ferencik, a professor of medicine at Michigan State University.
Hi, I'm Henry Barry, a family physician and one of the co-founders of InfoPoems. We are recording at the end of a difficult week. Our friend and colleague John Hickner died at home on August 22nd, and his funeral was just this past Monday. So we are all still a little bit tender in our emotions and feelings. We just recorded a tribute to John for our listeners who are interested in learning more about John and his impact on each of us. We invite you to listen to that.
Thanks, Henry. On this podcast, we highlight poems or patient-oriented evidence that matters. If you want to get all of the poems, you can subscribe to Essential Evidence Plus, where you get a poem every day, plus a primary care reference with over 800 disease and symptom chapters. Check it out at essentialevidenceplus.com. The opinions expressed on Primary Care Update are those of the commentators, and this podcast doesn't represent medical advice or the endorsement of any product. If you go to IAFP.com, you can get CME credit for listening to this podcast from the Illinois Academy of Family Physicians. Check out their online IFP education webpage and find our podcast. This week, we're going to discuss pharmacogenomic guided antidepressant therapy, non-drug interventions for children with functional abdominal pain, vitamin D and fracture risk in the elderly, and a really nice guideline for persons with type 2 diabetes. Kate.
So I have an abstract this week that is going to address the question of whether pharmacogenomic guided antidepressant therapy is helpful in the management of adults with major depression. So pharmacogenomic guided therapy is based on the idea that different people will metabolize medications differently depending on the genetic coding for different enzymes that they have. And that in turn should preferentially guide how we tailor the medication choices that we make. So if you are coded for one kind of enzyme, that should then inform what SSRI we choose to prescribe. That's the basis for this. The problem, of course, is that especially for antidepressants, there's no reason to think that serum levels, for example, that is the sort of consequences of metabolism, have any influence on treatment effects. So we essentially know precious little about how SSRIs actually work sort of in vivo in actual human beings, which is probably a better research question, but that's not where we are. We are asking this research question. So these investigators designed their study to figure out exactly that. So did access to the genomic information improve the patient-oriented outcomes in patients with depression? I'm unreasonably excited to talk about this study because people have been asking me about essentially this question, like what's the point of all of this sort of, this is personalized medicine or precision medicine. So I'm glad that they did this study, and I'm even more excited to tell you about the results. So they identified about 1,900 adults between 18 and 80, nice widespread there, with standard diagnostic criteria for major depression, who had had at least one prior treatment episode. And in this study, the clinicians were either planning to switch treatment or to initiate a new therapy. So a reasonable time to have this information. They all underwent DNA collection and then were randomly assigned concealed allocation to either a group where the clinicians got this pharmacogenomic information within 3 days or where they had to wait until the end of the study, 24 weeks, to get the results. So then the clinicians use that information to initiate therapy in the intervention group or not. They followed the folks up at five times over the course of 24 weeks, and they had about an 80% follow-up rate, which is pretty good. So what they found is that if the clinicians got this pharmacogenomic information, they were more likely to avoid what they described as a drug-gene interaction. But they found no difference in remission rates at their primary endpoint, which was 24 weeks. They did, as I said, they followed them up at 4, 8, 12, 18, and 24 weeks. And so chances being what they are, they did find a couple of those intervals that there were some increase in remission rates. So at 8 and 12 weeks, in remission rates were increased, but not at 4, 18, or 24 weeks. And 24 weeks, as I said, was their primary endpoint. So what that kind of suggests is that overall, taken as a whole, there is no statistically significant difference in in outcomes when you use the results of these pharmacogenomic precision medicine tests to guide SSRI therapy. What you would expect if there really is a true benefit is that you would see the results immediately or at 8 weeks, and that that would continue throughout therapy. So the fact that you see it at two time points, but not all of them, I really think we can spend our money elsewhere for the time being. The other big downside for me is that it sort of spoils me on a lot of precision medicine, which is not a fair outcome to take. I think there's probably hope for it on some of the like anticoagulation studies that were. Therapeutic nihilist that I have learned to be. Henry, what do you think?
Well, there's hope and then there's reality. And right now we have to deal with the realities. So, you know, this is interesting because for several years at Michigan State University, I was one of the course faculty for this integrative exercise. It was a 4-week block where I worked with about 8 students on projects that were supposed to address thorny issues such as should all physicians be screened for HIV? And it turns out that for a couple of years, several years, I worked with a group on whether or not we should be using pharmacogenomics. And the students had to integrate clinical issues, research, ethics, health policy into developing position statements. And what was really interesting is that the students went through all the kinds of permutations of recommendations, but ultimately, most of the time they said, well, you know, it's not ready for prime time. We can do things to lay a foundation for this, but it's just not there yet. And what's really neat to know is that here we are now 5, 6, 7 years later, and it's still not there yet.
Gary, any comments?
Well, it reminds me of the warfarin gene. So you probably are aware there are some genetic markers that have an effect on the metabolism of warfarin when we were still using warfarin. And one of the big studies came out was pharmacogenetic guided warfarin dosing versus our traditional clinical dosing. They randomized patients to one or the other. Absolutely no difference between the two. So I'm like you, Henry. There's a lot of hope, but I don't know yet if there's been any trickle down to make it a practical, usable, actionable part of our practice.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not aware of any positive trials. There could well be some, but I'm familiar with a lot of negative trials, and it's in the category for me of good idea, but not ready for prime time.
And of course, this is different than cancer pharmacogenetics. You know, that's a whole different ballpark. We're talking about mostly the things that we do in the daily
right process. Right. Yes, exactly. For the drug dosing. Yeah, that's true. That is an area where, of course, there is good data. Henry, you got a quiz.
Thank you. Which of the following statements about screening for impaired visual acuity is true? A, universal screening does not identify more individuals than targeted screening. Treatments for impaired visual acuity are effective. C, the harms of treating screen-detected impaired visual acuity are frequent and serious. The USPSTF recommends screening at a B level. Stay tuned.
Okay, and I'll throw it right back at you, Henry. Functional abdominal pain in kids. What works?
Thank you. This study asks the question, which interventions are effective in decreasing pain in children with functional abdominal pain disorders by Gordon and colleagues in JAMA Pediatrics this past June? The authors searched a whole bunch of databases and registries, and they tried to identify published and unpublished randomized trials of what they called psychosocial interventions for children with functional abdominal pain disorders. And they included studies of children between 4 and 18 years of age using specific diagnostic criteria for the functional abdominal pain disorders. They included 33 trials with just over 2,500 children. Interesting, two-thirds of the children were girls. The studies ranged from 5 days to 4 months, so really limited in that regard. There were a whole bunch of things that they were able to extract on cognitive behavioral therapy, educational support, different kinds of hypnotherapy and stuff like that. But there were some interventions that they just couldn't pool the data. They weren't reported in a way and they didn't go and contact the authors. And that included things like osteopathy, fiber intake, biofeedback. When they did the analyses of the study quality, it turns out that for the most part, only one study was actually of decent quality and all the rest were mixed to poor. What they ultimately found was that cognitive behavioral therapy was more likely than no intervention to, quote, successfully treat, end quote, children. They didn't define what successful treatment meant, so I don't know exactly what this means. It turns out that the numbers needed to treat was about 5, so it looked pretty robust for whatever that outcome meant. When they also looked at different forms of hypnotherapy, it turns out that hypnotherapy was better than no therapy. But in terms of head-to-head kinds of analyses, really not much much there. So the existing data that we have on this is from a small number of participants. It really has lots of limitations. It looks like CBT and hypnotherapy may be modestly effective in decreasing pain, but cost and access can be really significant issues. Mark.
Yeah, you know, as we've said before, if we could put cognitive behavioral therapy in a pill and then bottle it and sell it at the pharmacy, we'd be all set, right? It's an incredibly useful type of therapy for many problems, and that can be kind of recalcitrant to other interventions. So, you know, the challenge is access. There are, as we've also said before, online, self-directed, you know, telemedicine approaches to cognitive behavioral therapy. But again, access and ability to engage with that's going to be an issue. Kate?
I have two comments. One of them is diabolical. The other one is serious. I'll start with the serious. The CBT, we have to remember, is not necessarily any better than other forms of psychotherapy. It's just much easier to study. You know, you give somebody a workbook or, you know, you engage with them in a really specific way. It's time limited. It's very specific. It's replicatable. Everybody in a CBT intervention group can kind of do the same thing. And so that really lends itself to research, whereas interpersonal therapy or hypnotherapy, as they say, has to be much more tailored. It doesn't lend itself to a specific time course. And so one of the reasons that we see CBT so much is, again, just that it lends itself to research. The diabolical comment is we should think about branding some placebo pills as CBT, and we should see if we can get more of them on Amazon. Because I feel like that's there's real possibility there.
Yeah. And sometimes a cigar is just a cigar, right? Speaking of Freudian therapy and
CBETE.
Hey, excellent. And I'm next. And this is actually one of John's favorite topics, vitamin D. And this is a huge study. I think it is really a very definitive study on this topic of does supplemental vitamin D reduce the risk of fracture in older adults? And I take issue with the fact that they define older as anyone over 50 for men and over 55 for women. This was in the New England Journal of Medicine by LaBoff and colleagues. It was part of the Vital series of studies, supplemental vitamin D and incident fractures in midlife and older adults. Oh, midlife and older. Okay, good. So this was a really well-designed, federally funded study. They randomized about 26,000 men 50 and older, women 55 and older, to get 2,000 international units of vitamin D per day, or 1,000 milligrams of omega-3 fatty acids per day, or both, or two placebos. Patients weren't selected on the basis of their fracture risk or vitamin D levels. The main goal of this study was actually to look at cancer and cardiovascular outcomes for these two drugs. But they also recorded information about fractures. They asked patients every year, did you break anything? And if they said, yeah, I think I might have broken something, they checked their medical records. The average age of the folks in the study was 57 years. Just over half were women and 20% were Black. About a quarter of participants had a baseline vitamin D level less than 24 nanograms per milliliter. About 1.5% had a super low level below 12 nanograms per milliliter. About 42% in each group were taking supplemental vitamin D, and those folks agreed to limit it to no more than 800 milligrams per day or I'm sorry, I guess it would be 800 international units per day during the study. There were almost 2,000 fractures in just over 1,500 patients. And there was no difference between groups in total, non-vertebral, hip, or osteoporotic fractures. They looked at more than a dozen subgroup analyses that they'd pre-specified. They found no benefit in patients who were taking none of their own supplemental vitamin D, so they separated that group out, or calcium, and in patients with a previous fragility fracture. They found no effect of age, sex, BMI, no difference in fracture rates in different quartiles of vitamin D levels at baseline, including patients with a vitamin D less than 24, and even in those who had a baseline vitamin D level less than 12. There were no differences in groups with regards to renal stones or hypercalcemia or other adverse events. So that's the bright side. But, you know, this was a large, well-designed, careful study. Vitamin D is a very good marker of ill health, but it's a terrible treatment target. This, I think, definitively for me shows that supplemental vitamin D doesn't reduce the risk of fracture, even in people with a low baseline vitamin D level or a previous fracture. Gary.
We keep spending a lot of money answering the same question the same way. I remember our therapeutic nihilist colleague, John, going through the world's literature on this. And of course, you can find an occasional study with a positive statistical result because you have so many of them out there. But the general theme is, it seems that we're getting the same answer for the same intervention for multiple different conditions, and this one would be fracture risk and falls and those types of things as well. Is this a settled question now? That's my question to you all. And what do we do with this? You know, I still have patients taking vitamin D. Do we encourage them to stop it? Is it better to be sufficient than deficient? But in this particular study, Mark, it suggests that if you're deficient, you had no better outcomes than if you were sufficient and supplemented.
And of course, the other vital trials, the primary outcomes for cardiovascular outcomes, cancer outcomes, found no benefit either. And so,
but vitamin D is big business. So this is a zombie sticky. That will not die.
Sticky idea, isn't it? It's kind of a sticky idea. It makes sense pathophysiologically. We've been doing it forever. It seems pretty harmless. You know, a lot of people are low, especially once they change the definition to 30 from 20. And it's just a very, very sticky idea. Kate, any final thoughts about this one?
Yeah, I think one of the paradoxes is that a low level is clearly associated, although causally we have no idea, clearly associated with lots of poor health outcomes. So one of the questions is the answer to never get deficient? Because it's clear that we also can't reduce or improve those bad health outcomes by supplementing once you're deficient. And I don't think that's the answer. I'm with you. I think that it's just a confounder. It's a correlate because, you know, so consistently we don't seem to be able to improve it. But I don't think that any of you understand how easy it is to measure and that's what seems to drive so much of our interest in vitamin D. It's so easy to measure.
When I worked in a clinic for the uninsured where we had very limited budget, some of the docs who were coming in to volunteer would be ordering vitamin D levels on these patients and then getting follow-up vitamin D levels 6 months later and spending $600 of our precious lab budget on... Not good. Anyway, okay.
Yeah.
See if we drove another stake in the demon that is vitamin D supplementation. All right, Gary, you've got the final poem, which is a really nice guideline on type 2 diabetes.
So one of my favorite acronyms for a bureaucratic institution, the NICE, the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence. We need to come up with an acronym for KIND. So at the end of this, I'm going to see if anybody can come up with an acronym for KIND. This is out of Great Britain. They're a little late to the game. I just want to state that. They're now talking about SGLT2 inhibitors in the management of type 2 diabetics, which I'll talk about in a minute. You got to remember that the ADA, the American Diabetic Association, and even the AHA, the American Heart Association, have endorsed the use of these agents dating back to the last 2 to 3 years or so. Be that as it may, this was published, I believe, in a British Medical Journal just this past August, and it really talks about which factors that we need to consider when choosing drug therapy for type 2 diabetics. And their bottom line is that in patients who have chronic heart failure, who have established atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease or are at high risk, and we'll talk about that in a minute, and last year's guideline, evidence of chronic renal disease, there is a preference now for putting these patients not just on metformin, but then very quickly adding an SGLT2 inhibitor with proven cardiovascular beneficial effects, which I'll talk about in a minute. So it's a triage question. I have a patient in front of us. Do they have any of these high risk factors? If so, almost like knee-jerk, put them on an SGLT2 inhibitor. When they talk about the high risk patients, they use something called the Q-RISC2. So I'd get be interesting to find out from any of you if you're familiar with this, but it was developed in Great Britain, and it looks like the 10-year cohort equation on steroids. They even include, for people living in Great Britain, postal code, which I thought was brilliant because it does bring in this whole idea of, you know, some of the social determinants of illness and the like. So this was UK developed. You don't need to put in a UK postal code in order to get it to work. I ran my own stats just earlier today. I'm at about a 14% risk. So very similar to the 10-year cohort equation. If in the Q risk 2, you're greater than 10%, you fall into this high risk category. So what are the SGLT2 inhibitors that have been proven to have cardiovascular benefit? They only come up with three of them, even though there's probably six or seven right now. It's the empagliflozin, which is the trade name is Jardiance, canagliflozin, which the trade name is Invokana, and dapagliflozin, the trade name is Farxiga. Those are the three preferential drugs that they talk about as having a proven cardiovascular benefit. So how do we operationalize this? We have a patient in front of us. They're now a candidate for pharmacotherapy. Both the American Diabetic Association and the NICE guidelines say metformin number one. Very quickly thereafter, they say soon as metformin tolerability has been established, and you could probably establish that within a week or so, then you should pull the trigger on using the SGLT2 inhibitor and adding it to the patient's to their medical therapy. So we're talking about basically almost starting with two drugs, metformin plus the SGLT2 inhibitors. Very interesting to me is they minimize the GLP-1 agonists. They say basically, they said an economic analysis found that the GLP-1 receptor agonists were not cost-effective options for cardiovascular risk reduction, etc., which is diametrically opposed to what the ADA and I believe also the AHA is saying as well. So that's where the guidelines seem to differentiate a little bit. And one of the last things I'm going to leave with here is one of the things I forgot about actually is that these can induce diabetic ketoacidosis. And one of the risks, if you will, for developing diabetic ketoacidosis on an SGLT2 inhibitor is people who are following a very low carbohydrate diet, which is a very common thing that people may be doing for lots of reasons and the like. So just keep that in mind that if you're prescribing these medications, to at least have some higher index of suspicion for developing DKA if they're following a low carbohydrate diet. I think I've done reasonable justice to that.
Okay, why don't you go ahead?
Yeah, so a lot of takeaways, and I'll try and keep it short. But the one of the things that we know is targets are not static. They need to be adjusted based on the patient in front of you, the patient's individual risk, especially their risk of hypoglycemia and hypoglycemic unawareness. And that's, I think, one of the biggest takeaways from all of the recent guideline updates is it's not a static 7, not a static less than 7, but the older your patient is or the sicker your patient is, the higher that target should probably be because we are doing harm by pushing those targets too low, you know, definite iatrogenic harm. The other sort of the short version of all of these updated guidelines is that the sort of standards of medical care and diabetes, that flow chart used to be really straightforward. It was sort of like metformin and then like, you know, choose your own adventure. And it's much more complicated now. Just like Gary was saying, you know, it's sort of like if this, then that, if, you know, and I think it's going to get, it's going to become more and more complicated as we get better and better evidence for sort of the next medication selection. And then access is still an issue for all of these, especially for the Flozins, at least among my patients. They're difficult to get. They almost always require a prior auth. And I wish they wouldn't because of the, again, strong and increasing evidence for you know, longevity and mortality benefits.
Yeah, I think part of the, you know, the UK, this is a UK guideline. The economic analysis is in the UK where they negotiate hard for drug prices. And probably the drug prices are extremely different in the UK than they are here in the States. And that's probably where that SGLT2, GLP-1 difference came in. Henry, can you close us out on this topic?
Remember that a stopped clock is right twice a day. For years, I've been saying that glycemic control in patients with type 2 diabetes is largely irrelevant. The type 2 diabetes is a complex metabolic disorder in which hyperglycemia is a manifestation. It is not the disease. And glucose-focused therapies are doomed to fail, and we have seen this over the years. And so what we're seeing through all of these organizations is recognition that we need to be paying attention to the cardiovascular and renal risk factors and dealing with more inflammation and the like. And the analogy is, if you had a patient with metabolic alkalosis and hypokalemia, supplementing them with potassium isn't going to fix the problem. And we have many other conditions that are very similar to this.
Thanks, Henry. Gary, you got a comment?
Just to that point, both Kate and Henry's, the recommendation for starting these is risk-based and not A1C-based, right? And so both, you know, all of the organizations that I've mentioned say these should be started if in the right patient, irrespective of the A1C. So just FYI.
Excellent. Great final comment. Thanks, Gary. And Henry, you got the quiz answer for us.
Which of the following statements about screening for impaired visual acuity is true? Universal screening does not identify more individuals than targeted screening. Treatments for impaired visual acuity are effective. The harms of treating screen-detected impaired visual acuity are frequent and serious. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommends screening. Well, the task force actually found evidence that universal screening identifies significantly more individuals with correctable impairment than targeted screening. And they also found that treatments are effective for the common causes, including refractive errors, cataracts, and dry or wet age-related macular degeneration. But there was no real difference between universal and targeted screening in terms of outcomes, visual acuity loss 3 to 5 years down the line. And if you think about it, if you're going to start sticking needles in somebody's eyeball for some of these treatments, there are some potential harms. So the task force basically said that, you know, the harms are probably low. So they ended up with an I statement saying that the current evidence is insufficient to assess the balance of benefits and harms. On the other hand, the American Academy of Ophthalmologists, they continue to recommend a comprehensive eye examination every 1 to 2 years for people over 65. And the American Academy of Family Physicians says that the current evidence is insufficient, basically going along with the task force. So the correct answer is B. We can treat it.
Yeah, it's funny how the dermatologists recommend an annual skin exam and the ophthalmologist an annual eye exam. Funny how
that is. You go to your barber and ask if you need a haircut, you know what the answer is going to be.
And the radiologist an annual mammogram. And yes, okay, well, that's me being cynical. Thanks, guys. I appreciate it. Gary, thank you for joining us. I really enjoyed having you on board. And again, for folks who might have missed the previous podcast, do take 10 or 15 minutes and listen to our memories of John Hickner, who very sadly passed away a little over a week ago. And hopefully you can join us in a couple of weeks for more primary care updates. Thank you.